Pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate, you're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome back, dear listener. We're up to episode 46 of the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove, and we have a special guest with us. The 12th man has made yet another appearance. Paul, how are you?
I'm good, Trevor. How are you today? Hello, listener. How are you?
Great to have you back. I'm really proud of my nickname for you, the 12th man.
Are you?
Yeah, okay. I think it suits you absolutely perfectly, the way you just chime in when we need you.
Okay, terrific. I'm happy to be of service.
Yeah. So we've got lots of stuff to go through, Paul. And first up, I've got a link to an article. This is by Peter Martin, economics editor for The Age. And the headline is, "What kind of government better funds private schools than its own?" And he says, "Something is seriously wrong when private school students get more in government support than the government's own students. It's happening and neither side of politics wants to talk about it." And he gives a couple of great examples, Paul. You can check out the examples in your own suburb by scouring the My School website. And he says here, for example, in Balwyn.
Actually, the Melbourneites, I think, pronounce it Bourne, don't they sometimes?
They could do. Okay.
Very long time ago, I went to the Sunbury Music Festivals just outside of Melbourne.
Right.
And I hooked up with a very gorgeous young woman. And she was from North Bourne, is how she said it. North
right.
Bourne.
Okay. B-A-L-W-Y-N. Mm. Bourne. Okay. So in Bourne, the government-run Bourne Primary.
It's probably Baldwin, but anyway, yeah, that's how she said
that's
it.
That's where your ex-girlfriend went to. She might have gone to the Bourne Primary. Well, the government-run Bourne Primary gets $7,214 of government funds per student, while down the road, the privately run St. Bede's Parish Primary gets $7,974. They get $700 more per student.
That's scandalous, isn't it?
Plus whatever they get then from the parents.
Scandalous.
He gives another example. In Preston, Newlands, Newlands Primary gets $10,362, but Sacred Heart, same suburb, gets $11,488. In Spotswood Primary gets $8,008, while St. Margaret's Mary's gets $11,397. And in Ballarat,
how did they justify that?
I'll tell you, the North Primary in Ballarat gets $8,158, while St. Patrick's gets $8,499. These are the same suburbs, and the private schools are actually getting more. And you know why it is?
Yes, it's because those private schools take all the kids with, disabilities or need extra care.
No. Right? No, they don't.
Oh.
No, it's because when they brought in, Gonski funding, for example, the rule was, like, the idea of Gonski is that that you provide more money for schools based on the clientele and needs, etc. Yep. But the problem is that they told Gonski, whatever report you come up with, no school can be worse off. So these private schools that already had great deals have been able to maintain those great deals.
So how would they persuade the funders that they're worse off and need more money? How do they do that?
Well, they don't have to, because they simply get what they were getting before will not be reduced, and they're under such a good deal before Gonski that they will not have their funds reduced because of Gonski.
So they were already getting
more? Already.
Before Gonski?
Yes. Yes. So
how did they swing that?
Well, it's no doubt a complicated story, but that's one of the reasons. So if only they were taking, disadvantaged children, etc., but the kids who really need special help, they're all in the state system.
Yeah.
That's right. So they're putting under stress.
Yeah.
So there's a graph there showing that overall by 2020 the government schools will be on average less. So that's obviously picked out a few examples. Currently the average shows that the government schools get slightly more, but when you look at the trends, the government schools will eventually by 2020 be behind the Catholic and the independent ones. It's an people don't understand the system, I reckon, 12th man, of education in this country and what's happening to it. So it's just, the private system's just working it to the detriment of the
state system. They're rotting the system, aren't they, really? Yep. I mean, there's no way around it. There's no way of putting it any more gentle than that. They're rotting the system.
Yeah. This article says that the big problem was that Gillard had decreed that no school will lose a dollar. So that's made Gonski expensive. And so that's kind of the reason for it. And the majority of funding in Gonski was like a six-year program, and the majority of the funding was to kick in years 5 and 6. Mm-hmm. So that extra money that would push the government schools above the private schools hasn't come in. So that's why we're in the state that we are in. So it's appalling.
It is appalling. And I don't know about you, Trevor, I think it's a deliberate strategy on the part of particularly the coalition government to let the public school system deteriorate to the point where parents just abandon it in droves. And it becomes an irrelevance, or it becomes a sort of social security safety net type education system that only people who really cannot afford any kind of private schooling would use. Is that their strategy?
I think it is, yeah. And the Labor Party, played to that. Like Bill Shorten at one point was talking about, struggling parents who were just struggling to get extra money to put their kids in private school, as if that was the aspiration that Labor people should have. Just didn't make sense. His aspiration should be to make the state school system fantastic. I mean, in other countries, kids go to state government schools, folks. Like, we are ridiculously out of step with the rest of the world. We're talking not only Scandinavian countries, but America.
Up to university,
yes,
most American kids go to state schools.
Indeed, only about 10%. A really tiny amount. Like we're up to 40%. We are totally out of step with the rest of the world, and we need to do something about that. So
I'd like to know where Shorten et al. Send their kids. Do they send their kids to state or private?
I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of a what is it? It almost becomes an inevitability, doesn't it? When they let the public school system run down to that degree, that anybody who, thinks about it don't want their kids to go there.
The problem is that people say, you've paid your taxes, you should be entitled to get the government money for schools. And if you want to contribute more yourself, you should be able to.
Yeah.
But the problem with that is that the kids who have difficulties and need extra time, where do they end up? In the state school system. And that system gets overburdened with time-consuming kids and problem kids and getting the same money
They've always been under-resourced, but they just become even less resourced, don't they?
Yeah. So anyway, that was an interesting article by that guy from Sydney Morning Herald. Read that one. It's amazing that kids at schools in the same neighbourhood are getting different amounts for private schools. Yep. Andrew Bolt produced an opinion piece in the News Corp papers, and basically the theme of it was that Christians are being harassed out of the public space.
Did he say that?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
He did. And he gave a few examples and said that these attacks were part of a disturbing pattern. Everywhere Christians are being harassed out of the public space. And Some of the interesting things he... Well, what he went on to say was that... he says, true, attacks on the church are nothing new. What is new, though, is the ignorance of so many about what's at stake and their indifferences to the fight. How many young Australians, even young journalists, understand just what Christianity teaches and inspires? 12th man.
Is Andrew Bolt a Christian?
Well, he says at the end of the article he's not, but I've heard him... Well, I've read his stuff and I'm convinced he's a Christian, but anyway... he talked about that incident where a prisoner at Kempsey Prison was tattooed with an E4E on his forehead by a Muslim guy. Did you hear about that? Well, he wasn't tattooed. It was carved into his head by a fellow prisoner.
It happened to be
E4E, which was meant to stand for eye for an eye. And, this...
And the Muslim guy was illiterate. Well, couldn't spell eye.
Well, no, it was just easier for him to carve that into the... into the other guy's unwilling head. Like, two prisoners had a fight. Muslim guy gets control of the Aussie guy who was a former soldier and with a knife carves E for E in his head, eye for an eye. And Andrew Bolt then uses that to launch into saying that, well, basically that's just Islam. It's that sort of nasty eye for an eye type thing, whereas Christianity is a turn the other cheek type of thing.
Wasn't always, was it?
And if, you know, and basically the article is, stop bashing Christianity because if you, it's what's responsible for all that's good in the world.
Oh, yeah.
And Islam will take control if you put Christianity down. And that was the thesis. Yes. And so Scott, of course, he says, not Scott, 12th man, what am I saying? This difference explains why no Christian country has an eye-for-an-eye justice system, but a Muslim theocracy such as Iran does, is one of his statements.
That may be a valid point.
Well, does China have an eye-for-an-eye justice system?
I don't think so, no.
No, and they're not Christian.
No, they're not.
Yeah. So,
they just take you out and shoot you.
Yeah. But yeah, but it's not an eye for an eye. It's just a...
It's just, sorry, yeah. we've had enough of you. You're out of here.
Yeah, I mean, do Buddhist countries have an eye for an eye justice system?
I wouldn't have thought so.
No. So it's a complete nonsense on his part to say that that's a Christian thing.
No, it's not.
And this is the thing that, you know, one of my bugbears, 12th man, is, you know, Christianity, they plagiarised the Golden Rule and claim it as a Christian idea.
I think the Golden Rule is a kind of universal rule, isn't it?
It is indeed. And before I get on to the history of the Golden Rule, which is in the next article, finally, one of the other things he says is, consider which societies are safest for non-believers, which the most likely to be democracies, which the least likely to treat terrorists as heroes, which are least likely to allow humans to be destroyed for an allegedly higher cause. Each time the answer is Christian. We might be right to some extent, but I think he forgot about Ireland. Like,
look, I think he's really talking about countries that are now largely secular, that have a history of Christianity in their cultural evolution. But as we know, the European Enlightenment is what is really responsible for the taming of the harsh parts of Christianity. And for our, you know, liberal humanistic values that underpin most of our values these days. It's not from Christianity so much as from the European Enlightenment, where people actually questioned Christian dogma.
That's an idea we have to get across to people, though. I'm sure that in discussions with people, and we say, you know, what are you all about? Well, we've got a problem with religion. Yeah. And people go, well, you know, they do some good things and give us some moral guidance. And the answer is...
Not really.
No. And, you know, these are all things that people came up with without Christianity. It was around before Christianity. It'll be around after Christianity's
and
gone.
And in fact, they came up with them in response to the excesses and the brutality of what Christianity used to be in European civilization.
But even before that, so I've got this other article here, 12th man, and talks about this golden rule, the turn the other cheek, do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
That's
and basically saying that this, the golden rule was plagiarized. The concept dates back to the Egyptian Middle Kingdom, which is 2,000 years before Christ, where the words, now this is the command, do to the doer to cause that he do thus to you.
Sounds familiar, doesn't
Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Yeah. Then emerged in the Babylonian code, this is in the 1780 BC, as well as in the Mahabharata, 8th century before Christ, where they said, the knowing person is minded to treat all beings as himself. It appeared in Homer's Odyssey, 6th century BC. I will be as careful for you as I will be for myself in the same need. Beautiful. It appeared in the 6th century in Taoism. Regard your neighbour's gain as your own gain and your neighbour's loss as your own loss. In the 5th century before Christ, in Confucianism, never impose on others what you would not choose for yourself.
Yeah.
And in the 4th century before Christ, in Mohism, for one would do for others as one would do for oneself. So every time a Christian just spouts this, turn the other cheek, it's a plagiarized idea from earlier times, and it'll be around after Christianity.
Like much of the Christian theology, in fact.
So also in this article, just at the beginning of it, I really like this one. The title of it is Christianity's Nightmare Question. And what it says was, if Jesus was God, why didn't he say anything new or even marginally useful? So, you know, he's on earth for 33 years, roughly. He didn't once mention bacteria, pasteurization, or the importance of dental hygiene. He didn't once explain the sun, the composition of the atmosphere, clouds, or soothes people's fears of lightning and thunder. He didn't once look up and explain to his friends the moon and the tides and the stars and the planets, the galaxy, etc. Or even a formula for sunblock. didn't point anyone in the direction of morphine. Didn't tell a single living being about the science of corrective optics. Didn't mention anything about better, faster, safer forms of transportation, communication, maths. Didn't even mention flushable toilets, a technology based on gravity alone, which would have saved thousands of lives lost to dysentery and cholera in the time of his alleged ministry, and tens of millions in the 2 millennia since. Like, not a single...
He fell a bit short, didn't he, in the information stakes?
Yeah. So that's one of my favourite all-time articles, that one's, saying that if Jesus was God, why didn't he at least give us a few hints on these things and save the world a lot of misery?
Indeed.
And the other second part of it talks about that golden rule and the early origins of it. So that's a good one. I'm going to keep that one aside. 12th man in the election campaign. Bill Shorten just came out in the last few days confirming that he will keep the exemptions which religions currently enjoy in relation to discrimination.
He did. He's afraid to take on the churches. Does he really, in his heart of hearts, believe that they deserve exemptions? I don't know. Maybe he does. But look, you know, the reality is very few politicians have the guts to take on the churches because they're afraid of losing votes.
Well, his words were, from Bill Shorten, we are not interested in telling religious organisations how to run their faith-based organisations.
Aren't they part of the Australian community?
That's right.
I was under the impression they were and that they were subject to the same laws and privileges and rights as the rest of us.
You know, Bill Shorten's happy to tell all sorts of people, you know, how to run their businesses or their lives in all manner of things.
But not the churches.
But, you know, so particularly when the church is happy to tell the rest of us how to run our lives in terms of, you know, abortion laws and gay marriage
in
and blah, blah.
They see it as their calling, don't they?
Indeed. So Bill Shorten, we are not interested in telling religious organisations how to run their faith-based organisations. Meanwhile, Bishop Michael Stead, chair of the Anglican Diocese of Sydney's Religious Freedom Reference Group. Oh, for goodness sake, 12th man. Like, another pet bugbear of mine, dear listener, is just the various groups. Like, it's not enough that we've got Catholics, Anglican, Presbyterians, blah, blah, blah. But even within those groups, they then have to just create little subgroups to comment on things. So
yeah.
We've got the Sydney's Religious Freedom Reference Group. And their chair, Bishop Michael Stead, said the diocese was delighted by Mr. Shorten's comments. This will help to guarantee the ongoing diversity of opinion and tolerance for diversity, which has been the hallmark of our nation, he said.
Yeah, I wonder if Mr. Shorten is interested in telling people who want to perform genital mutilation on their daughters that he's not interested in telling them how they run their children's lives. What do you think? Some people would claim that's an element of religious freedom, wouldn't they?
Well, they would. Like,
but he's not interested in telling people.
No.
He's not interested in infringing on their religious freedom, I take it.
Well, you know, he doesn't want to tell, you know, a group how to run their faith-based organisation. But 12 Man, like, this is almost Donald Trumpish, I reckon, by this bishop. Like, he's delighted that Bill Shorten has agreed that churches can continue to discriminate against people so they don't have to hire a gay man to be a teacher.
Heaven forbid.
Or a nurse.
Mm.
So he's delighted by that. And he says that will help guarantee the ongoing tolerance for diversity, which has been the hallmark. It's the exact opposite.
Well, diversity is one of the buzzwords at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, but
and tolerance, of course.
It does exactly the opposite. Like, it allows these religious groups to be intolerant of diversity. Like, people can just say the complete opposite of what's actually the case, and nobody stops them.
Some people would call it Orwellian. You know, it's doublespeak, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, we want to limit who we will tolerate in our organisation in the name of diversity and tolerance.
Yes, that's what it is.
It's doublespeak.
Yeah. So
straight out of 1984.
Yeah. So this is Bishop Michael Stead, chair of the Religious Freedom Reference Group, applauding Bill Shorten for his decision for promoting tolerance for diversity, when in fact what he's doing achieves the exact opposite.
Exact opposite, yes.
They just take us for fools, these people. Maybe he really believes that.
Maybe it's the principle of, if you say it often enough, people will start to believe it.
Yeah.
Or maybe, do you think, I mean, obviously, you know, we shouldn't generalise too much about the voter, but the voter out there, obviously there are, you know, a range of degrees to which the voter actually checks out these sorts of statements, and you know
I think that just keeps his flock happy. Like, I think the flock will just hear that and go, we're promoting tolerance for diversity, great. We're without even thinking about it, if they're not prepared to be critical in their thinking and just happy to swallow whatever's thrown at them, then they would just take that and go, oh, great. Okay, so like, well, that's all good. I can rest easy about that.
Yeah.
I think that's what it achieves.
I feel good now. I'm a tolerant, diversified person.
Yes, I'm part of a tolerant, diversified group.
That's right.
Did I send you this one about the Muslim property development?
You did.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, dear listener, in Melton South, which I guess it's in Victoria.
Mm.
A block will be transformed into housing targeted at the Islamic community, with 75 separate lots and a mosque built in the middle of the neighbourhood.
Right.
It's called Ikra Village and is said to become Victoria's largest faith-based little housing estate. This is a worrying development, 12 Man.
It's extremely worrying. I mean, especially in light of what we've been reading about ghettoisation of Muslim communities in Europe.
Yes.
And how once they you know, congregate in sufficient numbers, they effectively push out anybody who isn't one of them.
Yes.
And then, you know, all the worst things can happen. Mm. Women more scrutinized in yes. their behavior and they're dressed.
Mm.
You know, they have even less freedom because everybody around them is watching them and they're watching each other and nobody wants to be seen as the, you know, the odd one out. So you get a much more intensified level of conformity
mm.
and fundamentalism, dare I say it.
Mm. I mean...
Am I off the mark here?
Well, I mean, the criticism of the Muslim community hasn't integrated properly into Australian society.
Exactly. And this is achieving exactly what we don't want.
Yes.
What we want is more integration.
Yes.
Yes.
It's just, you know, by saying that, we could be criticised as being, you know, racist or something.
Oh, we will
like
be.
But the irony is that we're saying we want Muslim people in our communities
to integrate,
spread out we want them in our street. I want a Muslim neighbour across the road.
Why not?
I don't want my Muslim neighbour with 100 other Muslim families in a little enclave over in some suburbs on their own. So it's the exact opposite of racism, where you're actually saying, I want you. It's but you will be criticised for racism
and
for the
fact,
idea.
I think, you know, the shoe is on the other foot. Why not criticise the Muslim developer? If it is a Muslim developer, I don't know. Yeah. But criticise the person who thinks it's a good idea to concentrate people of one particular persuasion.
Yes.
It rings of racism itself, doesn't it? A little bit?
Yes. Yes, it does. I would have thought. Now, based on the previous article where we had the talk about the discrimination, Bill Shorten, the priest, very happy and said, you know, this is a great measure for, you know, step forward for tolerance of diversity. Like, with that sort of thinking in the community, back to this article about the Islamic State, what would you expect somebody to say about this? Like,
they would say, oh, that's a demonstration of Australia's tolerance and diversity.
Or what a great example of integration.
Yes.
Well, it's
the complete opposite of integration.
Well, let's just see. Did anybody have the hide to say anything like that? Let's just read on a bit further here. We've got Australian Federation of Islamic Councils Treasurer, Kaysar Trad, was interviewed by A Current Affair. And he said, this particular venture is an indication there's a feeling out there that there's perhaps less acceptance of Muslims. A project of this nature will allow people to be able to develop a local place of worship or a local school without too many objections from neighbours. They won't be getting in anybody's way. It's something within their local community. We've always encouraged our community to live among mainstream society and to build friendships and promote understanding and awareness. Well,
it sounds...
if you have, wouldn't you then criticise what has just happened? Like, we've always encouraged our community to live among mainstream society and to build friendships and promote understanding and awareness.
So on one hand he says that, and on the other hand he says it's a good idea that they're walling themselves off into an isolated community.
Yes, that's right.
Now, people often say, look, you know, Australia can absorb more Muslim migrants because Australia is a terrific example of how multiculturalism works. Now, from where I sit, multiculturalism has worked because all the people who've migrated here, or, you know, more or less all of them, have integrated.
Mm.
They haven't sort of huddled together in little ghettos.
Mm.
They have actually integrated and intermarried.
Mm. Well, that's the big thing, isn't it? Like, I would think, say, Italian immigrants would end up in certain areas. Like, like New Farm, for example, Italian families would sort of, a lot of them would end up there. Mm. And I went to a school called St. James's, which was in the valley, not far from New Farm. Mm. So, full of
Italian kids. Mm. And, you know, our soccer games at lunchtime used to be Italians versus the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And the Italians most of the time. Well, up until about grade 9, the Italians were always bigger. Because they would they would develop faster. Well, they would develop. They were shaving in grade 7, the Italians. And so, you know, you line up for your school photos and it would always be done in height, and then you'd be, you know, the class photo.
Yeah.
And in grade 8, a lot of the Italian boys were the tallest or near the tallest. And by the end of grade 12, they hadn't gained any height at all. And they were just the little Italian guys who are now at the bottom of the height scale. So, early years, Italians were a lot bigger and would easily win. And then probably by latter years, the Aussies might have been just a bit bigger. But anyway, I digress. but at least while there might have been, they weren't gated community, you know, they weren't. It was still mixed in amongst Aussies.
First generation migrants tend to congregate.
Yes.
Second generation, they start to move out. By the third generation, they're totally integrated.
Yes. And it would have been nothing for those kids, like, to have all those Italian boys that I knew to marry an Aussie girl. Like, it would have been perfectly the norm. Yeah. Not even thought twice about it. Yeah. So that is a terrible move.
It is, and as we know, there is a principle in I would hazard a guess, most Muslim parents would be very, very concerned if their child came home and said, "I'm going to marry a non-Muslim."
So we, well, it happens in the Indian community, doesn't it?
It does. Yes, the Hindu community is another example of that.
Mm.
However, we haven't had so many problems with the Hindu community in other respects, have we?
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting.
But I think the Hindus would be more inclined over several generations to intermarry.
Mm.
I don't think Hinduism is such a, doctrinaire sort of religion, you know, where everybody must conform or else.
But they're pretty keen on the marriage. Like my daughter worked in an Indian restaurant, and obviously, if I catch a taxi anywhere, it's invariably an Indian taxi driver, and it's a very common story to go back to India to pick up an Indian bride to bring back here. Very much expected and enforced on fellows who really aren't that keen. Like that's they'd true. Like to marry an Aussie girl. Mm. But a big cultural Indian thing.
Yeah, it is true. It is true. Caste is part of that, of course.
Yes.
Not only not marry a non-Indian, but not marry somebody in a lower caste. It's a big deal for a lot of Indians, I know.
So poo-poo on that idea as well, Hindu Indians who are doing that. Haven't heard of an Indian estates where people are congregating as heavily as that. Mm.
I had Indian neighbours some years ago.
Mm.
And they were fine. Mm. But there was a young woman in a family of business people who had been asked what kind of husband, you know, what profession she wanted her future husband to be in, and she said she wanted a doctor. So they arranged a doctor.
Right.
And so she was taken back to India and
hitched
up with a doctor.
Yeah. The Iron Fist, the Velvet Glove, and the 12th Man are all members of the Secular Party. There may be other contributors to the show who are also members. That does not mean that every opinion given on this show is policy of the Secular Party. To find out what is policy, go to the website of the Secular Party. And while you're there, think about joining and signing up, because we need more secularists in this world. Thanks. Right, another article. This lady who's found out that her daughter's little government school had a school prayer. I think this might be Victoria again.
Mm-hmm.
She found out that the school would, at the start of the day, have a school prayer, which was, "We pray for your blessing, God, on the work we're doing today, that we may do it both well in school and out. May we be good to each other and try to do well in all things and be honest, truthful and kind and respectful to all. All nice sentiments except for the first line, we pray for your blessing, God.
Yes.
It wouldn't have been that hard to just
delete that first
part lines, and just say, let's all be mindful of the need to blah blah blah. Yeah. Like, it's not that hard.
Yeah, it's not that hard, is it?
So anyway, in this article, the interesting thing is that the comments section of this article, so many people are going, well, what's the problem? Just a little prayer, get over it, no big deal, etc. You know, I want my kid to learn some religion, so I think it's a good thing that they do that. Like,
don't most people say, I want my kids to have some sort of moral compass, and they assume that that must come from religion.
Yes, yeah. So so that was the most disturbing thing, was the comments section in this. And fortunately, you know, the other commentators go for it and toing and froing, but just a disturbing number of comments where people go, well, actually, that's quite all right, and find bigger battles to deal with. So we've still got work to do out there, 12th man.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. I mean, that shows the lingering success of the churches in persuading people that all morality derives from religious principles and not from secular ones. So that's our job ahead of us.
One person here made a good comment and said, I'd argue that it does hurt someone. It gradually promotes the idea of prayer as being something that has value universally, of everyone being happy to do it, when really many people disagree wholeheartedly and operate on the assumption that a state school should be secular. So I agree with that one.
Yes.
And another one where this lady was sort of saying, well, I want my kids to have a bit of a religious education. And she says, well, it's religious instruction is doctrinal instruction in one religion only. And the program used widely in New South Wales and Queensland called Connect is a sin and salvation one. Religious instruction is about as far from education in multiple religions as you can get. Which is right. People don't understand that.
No, they don't. So that's our work ahead of us.
They think it's a harmless bit of moral guidance, or at least a harmless bit of perhaps cultural teaching. Oh, look, the Catholic bishops came out with a statement, and it was such a heap of guff. I can't go through it. It'll drive me crazy. I'm going to skip right past it, top man. They're clever. Preachers get in the door of schools in whatever way they can. And there's a guy called Reggie Dabbs, a motivational speaker, is a booming American voice and plays the saxophone.
Reggie Dabbs.
He speaks in schools about his tough upbringing with his prostitute mother being adopted and being bullied.
He sounds like the guy who came to McGregor High some years ago when I was working there.
Yeah.
And he was a very persuasive speaker.
Yeah.
And he didn't mention religion at all when he came to the school. It was meant to be a motivational...
And then he dragged... Yeah, then soon turned out he was a...
It was a promotion for a big rally.
Well, the answer is that story, because you have told that one before, it's still happening.
It's still happening.
So, and Reggie Dabbs is the current incarnation of that.
It looks like him, I think it's the same guy.
It's the same guy?
It's the same guy. Really? Sure. Yeah. Because he was a big guy. And he talked about his terrible childhood. Yeah. It's coming back to me now. As I said, it's a long time ago.
This is the guy from the 12th man story of the school. Guy. Right.
But do you know who got him into the school?
Well, the principal, who was an evangelical nutbag?
No. I don't know what the religious inclinations were of the principal at the time. No, it was the school chaplain who organised it.
Of course. So there you go. School chaplain says to the principal, hey, it'd be good for the kids to have a bit of a motivational speaker.
Self-esteem enhancement.
The principal's thinking, I've said the same speech to the kids for the last 5 years. I'm running out of material.
Yep.
How easy is this to get a guy in? What's he cost? Oh, nothing. Not a cent.
No.
Great.
Not only that, but he gives away free tickets to a fabulous big thing at the stadium where he puts on his rallies.
Yes. So in this article, it says, the main aim is to promote religious blue light disco style events with free food, prizes, motivational speakers and DJs. Some Victorian schools that have hosted Mr. Dabbs have gone on to encourage students to attend his church events. According to Ms. Wood, this is where the real work takes place. At this second event, they encourage kids to give their life to Jesus and join their youth groups. It's a clever formula. They know presenting yourself as a cool dude from the US will break down the barrier.
Mm.
They're sneaky. Well, that's interesting. You reckon that's the exact same guy that you've talked about before?
I'm like 90% certain it's the same guy. It just rings so true to my now vague memories of the event. Yeah.
Right.
How
long
ago was that? It was in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Right. Yep. Wow. 16 years later, still at it.
He's making a career of it, isn't he?
Yeah, well, that would be his job. Yeah. And,
And he's very good at it. Look, I have to give him credit. He was a very effective public speaker, very persuasive, charismatic. And I recall clearly walking out of the school hall afterwards, walking back towards the classrooms with a few other teachers, and virtually to a person, all the other teachers were praising this guy. They were saying, wasn't he wonderful? You know, he really boosted the kids' self-esteem. And
But, you know, it's like when the Aussie dollar was high, you know, we were a prime spot for a touring rock band, you know, the Rolling Stones. Like, all bands turned up at one stage. From his point of view, he'd be looking at it going, oh, well, there's a government-sponsored school chaplaincy program. All I have to do is make myself known to the school chaplains at some events or through their communication levels. They'll make the pitch to the principal, and there you go, I'm in, and put on a bit of a disco, get everybody happy, happy, clappy, clappy, and...
Now that you mention it, you know, how the rock bands used to come, some of the American evangelists used to, you know, swan down to Australia and pass around the buckets at the rallies and load it onto the plane tax-free and take it back to America with them, didn't they?
Why not? We're a fertile ground.
We are very fertile. But at the same time, now that the Aussie dollar's a bit low, it might not pay for their jet fuel to come all this way.
Yeah, not as worth it for them. Mm. You sent me an article, 12th Man, about a Czech politician saying that the West will have to crush Islam. A hard-hitting one.
Yeah, it was the sort of wording that would alarm some people. You know, I mean, it sounds violent, doesn't it, crush? And obviously, she mentioned in the article that if it comes to that, then the West may well have to resort to violence.
She says, is Islam compatible with Western democracy? Is it capable of reform? Can this end happily? And she says that on all three counts... the prognosis is bleak.
Yes.
She argues that the problem with Islam is not so much... it's not so much a religion as a totalitarian system of governance.
Mm.
Unlike Christianity, Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism and Shintoism, the religion's aspect is secondary to the legal one. I think she's got a point there.
I think she has.
From the viewpoint of Islam, the concept of religion as a private, intimate matter of an individual is absolutely unacceptable.
It's alien to Islam, I think, isn't it?
It is, she goes on, a belief system based on an extremely regressive, joyless view of the world. A couple of other lines, she says, unfortunately, Islam doesn't want to be miserable on its own. It wants to take the rest of the world down with it.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting line.
Yeah. And the other one was, Muslims have got very good at exploiting what they perceive as weakness in the West's liberal values.
Mm.
Islam likes to hide behind the religion's mask. It wants to be protected according to our tradition, which it exploits in this way, while it is not willing to behave reciprocally. Very true. It relies on our traditions. It claims that the traditions are important, while behind the scenes, it is laughing at us and our system of values. Mm. So that was a Czech politician and a pretty harsh analysis of Islam, some of which I think is true.
Yeah, look, Czech The Czech Republic is, I think, highly secularized, and I think the level of religious belief is extremely low.
I think that's right.
Among the population, yeah.
Well, 12th man, if the figures are right, and there's about 20 million refugees waiting at the doorstep of Europe, and Europe doesn't want them to come in, got any ideas on where they could go?
Yep.
Yeah.
The Gulf, the Persian Gulf.
Yep.
I hear there's a bunch of very affluent, cashed-up countries in that area where they have very similar cultural values, same religion, very similar customs, I would think. And that, guess what? They haven't taken any refugees yet, so they surely would have space for a few, wouldn't they, Trevor?
What's what that article I've got a link to is saying, that that the Gulf states have taken hardly any of the refugees, and
I heard it was zero.
Yeah.
Is it not?
Well, the article says it's possibly...
Jordan has taken refugees, quite a lot.
Mm.
Turkey has taken a lot, and Lebanon has taken a lot.
Yeah.
Those three countries have virtually taken the burden on, and Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states have kept everybody at arm's length.
Yeah, I think that article makes the point that they haven't signed refugee conventions, so they don't actually call them refugees, but it sort of limits the number at quite a low number anyway. But it makes the point that, I mean, Saudi Arabia is a Sunni Muslim state, and the climate the same, language is there. Really, they could fit in seamlessly, but what's this?
Wouldn't you think?
But also, there's the accommodation. Like, there's an enormous
tent city
that sits there unused
around Mecca.
That's required for only 5 days of the year, and the rest of the time is completely empty. So, here we go, 12th man. There's 100,000. High-quality, empty, fiberglass tents that can house about 3 million people just east of Mecca. They're fireproof, air-conditioned, complete with toilets and kitchens. This unique resource is occupied a mere 5 days a year by pilgrims on the Hajj. And there's a picture of it. Like, it's an amazing setup.
Yeah.
It is enormous amount of accommodation that is just sitting there, unused.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the Gulf states, Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and United Arab Emirates. Lots of advantages as to why they could take plenty of refugees. Geography, it's much closer. Climate, it's hot.
Yeah.
Language, it's Arabic. Economics, well, they have an insatiable need for labour.
Indeed, I was just going to mention that. So rather than import the labour from other countries, they could put them to work, surely. They would be grateful for the work, wouldn't they?
Legal system, reassuringly familiar.
Yes.
And the religion, Islam, Islam, Islam.
Exactly the same.
So yeah, pressure should be put on for Saudi Arabia and the like, the Gulf states. There's where some refugees could go.
Yeah.
Have you been keeping up with... America is going bonkers over transgenders in toilets.
In bathrooms, yeah.
It's unbelievable. Like,
wouldn't you think they would have more important issues to focus on?
Yes. So, Oklahoma lawmakers have introduced a bill that would allow students to request on religious grounds that their public schools provide a bathroom or other facility that bars transgender people. They've just got this really, really weird hang-up about transgender people, that people must go into the toilet that the gender matches what they were assigned at birth.
Yeah.
But the point is, what they want leads to a really strange situation, because you would have, a person who was born a female but is now, you know, transgendered into a male and looks every bit as male as you and I do, 12th man, they now want that person to go in
and totally freak out the children.
And everybody.
And everybody.
Like, they actually want to create...
They want to create problems.
Yes.
Rather than solve them.
Yes. So they want to... Like, nobody would notice if, in that situation... They
wouldn't know.
The transgender person just went into the... The gender toilet of what they're currently recognised
as. What they identify as, yes.
Yeah. Mm. So they're passing these laws. And, of course, it's just ludicrous because now you'll get people who you think shouldn't be in a toilet are there. And how are you going to enforce it? I mean, you're going to say to somebody, I need to inspect your genitals.
Do they have somebody on the door of the toilet?
What are they going to do?
Asking for birth certificates before they're admitted to the toilet.
Apparently, you're not even under law allowed to ask for somebody's birth certificate. Like, you cannot require somebody to produce a birth certificate. It's illegal. It's a privacy matter.
How are they going to police it?
They can't. It's crazy. But people make the point that we've had tens of thousands of people molested by priests and clergy. There is not a single statistic on people molested by a transgender person in a toilet. Like, there are no... It happens so little... In fact, it may never have happened, but it happens so little. But there isn't a statistic on it. They don't keep one. But we've got tens of thousands of priests who have abused, not only
Catholic priests, of course.
Have abused children. What they should be doing is passing a law requiring clergy to use their own toilet.
To stay out of public toilets.
Exactly. I mean, if they really were concerned about potential abuse and... It was kind of like a Facebook meme which our secular party posted on Facebook, and that did really, really well in terms of reach.
Responses.
Lots of people shared that one, and it's so true.
But it's part of the kind of pathological obsession that some religious people have with all things related to sex, don't they?
Yes, got an obsession with it, haven't they? Mm. Yeah, and what other people are doing, you know, I'm just really concerned about that. So.
Wouldn't you think they'd just leave it to God, because apparently God can see everything, knows everything. Wouldn't you think that, and if God's so powerful, why doesn't God just sort of put an invisible wall at the entrance and make it sort of just keep out the transgender people or whoever is going to do some harm? Not that I'm suggesting transgender people would do some harm, but, you know, if God is up there controlling everything, leave it to God.
The Lord works in mysterious ways, 12 man. Are you enjoying the show and would you like to help out? There's a few easy things you can do. You can like us on Facebook and you can go into iTunes and leave a positive review. That would be much appreciated. Also, if you're really keen, you could donate to us via Patreon. For details on how to do all this, visit our website. Thanks for your support. And now, back to the podcast. Samoa's going to change their constitution to declare that they're a Christian. Christianity is the official religion of Samoa.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the president... No, Prime Minister said Samoa must be cautious about embracing religions that promote violence and murderous rage as a form of worship. No prizes for whom he was thinking about there.
And no prizes to him for his knowledge of the history of the Christian church either.
Well, exactly. He says, Christianity, he says, does not do this.
Oh, never.
Mm-hmm. And that is why it's important that the constitution of Samoa is amended to reflect that Samoa is undoubtedly a Christian country.
Mm. Are you aware of the story some months back, I think it was last year sometime, Trevor, when the Parliament of Papua New Guinea, with great ceremony, accepted the delivery of a very old and very valuable Bible that was purchased for them by a wealthy American Christian? And gifted to them, I think.
Right.
And it was with great ceremony. It was installed in the Parliament building in Port Moresby, and the Prime Minister, and I forget who the Prime Minister's name now, but he very publicly stated that Papua New Guinea was a Christian nation, or you know, that their whole governmental system should reflect, you know, the Christian heritage. I thought that was a bit of a worry in a country where they have so much, potentially so much intercommunal violence.
No, I wasn't aware of that.
I mean, Papua New Guinea is just about the most intensively Christian missionized country on the planet.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I did quite a lot of reading about missionaries when I was at university, and that was an interesting thing I learned. Yeah, and coming from, you know, mainly from the United States, but all the, you know, mainstream Protestant and the Catholic churches were there. Because it was fertile ground, you know. It was the heathens. It was the backward people living in the darkness of, you know, pre-Christian religion, you know. And it was fertile ground. They were all in there.
Right, yeah. If you were an evangelical looking to convert a pagan, then this was...
What better place?
Yeah. Yes, the last remaining sort of place on earth where people hadn't... You could be the first white man to...
Could be,
to,
yes.
...that they would encounter, yeah.
So it's a heavily missionized place. And of course, one thing they used to do was go into a village and as soon as they got the confidence of the people, they would suggest to them that if they were true to their newfound Christian faith, they could prove it by burning the men's house and all the old totems. And they used to do that. They used to destroy all these artifacts, these priceless artifacts that the people had collected over generations.
Right? You
know? Yeah, and they burned them. They burned a lot of them because they were the work of Satan, of course.
We've previously mentioned, well, back to Samoa, we've previously mentioned Fiji. It's got a fantastically...
The whole Pacific was heavily Christian.
But Fiji's got a fantastically secular constitution there. Yes, magnificently secular. Way better than ours in that it's overtly secular. So... it can be done.
Is that why the what's his name, Jared Hayne, wanted to give up his American football career and join the Fijian Sevens? It's because of the fabulous constitution.
I don't think so.
It could be the backstory to this.
Yeah, no, I think it was probably because he got word he was going to be dropped from the 49ers and looked for another opportunity. I'd say it's probably probably what happened there. Oh, what have we got? Ah, here's a good one. So we've got this speech was given, Paul, to the House of Parliament in the UK, both houses. And my lords and members of the House of Commons, this lady said, and she said, the ministers will continue to bring the public finances under control so that Britain lives within its means. A good sentiment, and that poverty would be tackled, and so would the causes of deprivation, and the government would be reformed, so it would help the hardest to reach.
And which party was this person with?
Well, the problem was that the person calling for Britain to live within its means, this lady, she was at the time she was wearing a hat that was worth £1 million.
Does her name begin with E?
That's right, it was the Queen Elizabeth. So while wearing a crown worth £1 million, she implores the government to bring finances under control so Britain lives within its means and to tackle poverty and the causes of deprivation.
Look, Trevor, I think you're being a bit hard on the poor old Queen. I mean, realistically, I don't think she's in a position to sell the crown jewels, is she?
Well, it's ironic, isn't it?
It is ironic.
Oh, well, if you've got sympathy for her, then perhaps her last line might be the final straw. She finishes off with, "I pray that the blessing of Almighty God may rest upon your counsels."
Yeah.
She's still going strong. We've got her for another 10 years, I reckon.
She's, how old is she now? 90?
90s. Yeah. So she could easily get up.
Getting up there.
It wouldn't be a show without a quick mention of the ACL. Actually,
they're one of your favourites, aren't they?
I think regular listeners I probably started drinking games, 12 man, where every time
you mention the ACL,
they have to, you know, take a shot drink, of some sort. Or, you know, they might have been tempted to use the word submarine as well, because, you know, if they liked the alcohol, they would have done quite well if submarine was a secret word in a drinking game in the last few weeks. But
okay.
ACL, got an email from Lyle Shelton encouraging me to join him and the Lachlan Macquarie Institute at Campaign HQ, an exciting initiative for young future leaders to spend a week thinking biblically about how they plan their life's campaign.
How do you think biblically? It's a bizarre concept.
To think biblically. Well,
think biblically.
Yeah. At Campaign HQ, delegates will strategize, attend briefings, and participate in roundtable discussions looking at leadership, change, politics, philosophy, and importantly,
God.
The Bible. Oh. Close. University-aged Christians seeking to understand and engage in public leadership from a biblical perspective are invited to apply to attend this six-day live-in course. You know, they're just getting bright young people who have been brainwashed and getting them together, finding the smartest and most confident amongst them, the best talkers, getting them in for a week. You know, they have to pay like $250, $300, all inclusive. But like, that's all meals, lectures, course materials, accommodation.
Cheap,
like, it'd be impossible for us to throw some sort of convention for secularists that would only charge $300.
No, we
couldn't do it.
You
couldn't do
it. No. So perhaps we should go along and take advantage of their hospitality.
Yeah, maybe. But they've got so much money to play around with to work on the next generation. It's frightening, isn't it?
Yeah. There's a lot of money floating around the Christian world. There really is.
Mm. Imagine if we could do that, getting all the bright young people and getting them aside for a week and indoctrinating them into secularism and finding out who the really keen ones are and giving them jobs to do for the next year and keeping in contact. And anyone out there with a spare million or two who would like us to run that, let us know. Previously, there's been indicators, 12 man, that I'm potentially a psychopath.
Seriously?
Mm.
I didn't want to say anything, Trevor.
Yeah. Due to my career options, a number of the things I've done rank quite highly in the potential psychopath scale.
This is measured against some sort of objective measure.
There was a thing about, you know, which careers are most likely to
attract psychopaths.
Yes, yeah.
And your career choices were probably up there.
I think a lawyer was in there, and I forget exactly what the other ones were, but I ranked a couple quite highly in the first couple. And now they're saying, another article saying that atheists would actually be more likely to be psychopathic than
religious people.
Indeed. Interesting article. It talks about different sides of the brain that get switched on and off. And let me just see here. They did some experiments with people and asked them questions and then asked them other stuff. The research is based on the hypothesis that the human brain has two opposing domains in constant tension. In earlier research, Dr. Tony Jack, Associate Professor of Philosophy, used functional magnetic resonance imaging to show the brain has an analytical network of neurons that enables us to think critically and a social network that enables us to empathize. Different sides. So,
yeah.
When presented with a physics problem or ethical dilemma, a healthy brain fires up the appropriate network while suppressing the other.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, so that study wasn't good in terms of my likelihood of being a psychopath. Talk man.
Okay. So that's fair warning to the rest of us. It is. In the party, isn't it?
It is. Mm. And the public, for that matter.
And the public, yes.
Mm. Yeah. that's about it, Todd, man. Did you have anything? Did you have anything you want to go through? Dear listener, the 12th man is sitting here with his Secular Party of Australia baseball cap, which we've just had made. So with a bit of luck, I'll put something on Facebook when we're able to perhaps sell some of those on our website. Campaign flyers are almost printed, and we'll be hitting the streets with our A-frame and flyers.
Do you have plans of where you're going
to? I think anywhere where there's a big crowd, so probably the CBD. Yeah, that sort of thing. Outside of universities, lots of people going in and out of that. So wherever there's a big crowd, I think is probably where we'll be.
Promoting secularism and the secular party.
And we did quite well with Facebook in the last week or two. Some of the things there have gone really well, reached like 12,000 people, one of the posts, that sort of thing. So that's good.
I noticed there were some quite long-running commentaries on some of the posts.
So
particularly in relation, as you mentioned earlier, to prayer in schools.
Yeah.
And religious instruction in schools. There was an extensive commentary on that.
So it's a bit of a, you know, this is the quandary, isn't it? Like, do you stand outside a train station handing out flyers? How many people can you reach? How many, you know, what sort of effective engagement do you get? Are you better off, you know, on social media trying to get things out and reaching people that way? It's hard to know, isn't it?
I've recently on television, where they've been naturally being in the middle of a campaign, the journalists on television are interviewing a lot of politicians, and almost to a person, they're all saying it's absolutely essential to get out there and just be on the street, walking, going door to door, hanging around shopping centres and just talking to people, shaking hands, and talking to people. And they said that they're convinced that makes a huge difference in their electability.
Yes. I think that's... we've got to do both. And I think that's particularly the case, though, for people in the House of Reps who are in a local area who need to be seen as a local in the area, at the school fete, at the PNC meeting, at the local shopping centre. That sort of local connection for the House of Reps.
And it makes sense, doesn't it? Obviously, people want to feel that you're part of the community, at least nominally, even if you spend most of your working life in Canberra, away from the community.
So anyway, we'll be out on the streets and doing that. So look out for us if you're in the Brisbane CBD, and I gather the other states will be doing stuff. So I think the background music might have kicked in by now. So next week, Velvet Glove will be back. Thank you, 12th Man.
My pleasure.
Great job, as always.
Oh, thank you.
We in the secular world salute you. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, listener, for listening again.
Goodbye. Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe
you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It just, it'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation, so you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners, and that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.